People say life is like a chess match, but what if it's really more like a game of poker? That's what this author believes, and I bet you're going to like it. Hello and welcome to the 1-3-20 podcast, the show designed to give you the most value in the least time. I'm your host, Daniel Pink. In each episode, I choose one great book, ask its author three key questions, and get you on your way with big ideas and action items in less than 20 minutes. The 1-3-20 podcast. You're listening to this podcast because you care about learning and developing, and also, well, because HubSpot created it. If you want more great education to grow in your career, check out HubSpot's free online courses at hubspot.com/learn. Let's dive right in. Today's book is Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts. Its author is Annie Duke. She grew up in New Hampshire, graduated from Columbia University, and won a National Science Foundation fellowship to pursue a graduate degree in psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. But after earning her master's and finishing her doctoral coursework, her life took a turn. She moved to Montana and began playing poker. Yes, poker. She turned out to be pretty darn good at it, too. She went pro, and before long, she had won a World Series of Poker gold bracelet, the WSOP Tournament of Champions, and $4 million in earnings. Now she's out with a terrific new book that combines what she's learned from poker and from psychology. Annie Duke, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Your book is great, and on this show, we require guests to ante up before doing anything else. So let me ask you the first question. The question we always ask, what's the big idea? What's the big idea in thinking in bets?
The big idea is that all the decisions that we make are really bets. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we can make that explicit, it's a road to better decision making. So people tend to think about bets confined to casinos and gambling games against, you know, a dealer or other players. But what a bet really is a decision informed by the beliefs that you have about the kind of future that you're trying to create for yourself. And those futures are uncertain. So once we sort of realize that, I mean, if I'm betting on a hand of poker, for example, I'm betting based on my beliefs, lots of beliefs about the other players, about what kind of hand you might have, about what kind of hand you think that I have, about what bet might be most effective, that I choose among my tool set to try to get the result I want, but the result is never certain. And that just sounds a lot like every single decision that we make.
So, Annie, you say there are exactly two things that determine how our lives turn out. What are they?
So those two things are the quality of our decisions and luck. And in order to become a better decision maker, you really want to do two things. The first, obviously, is improve the quality of your decisions. But the second is get really, really comfortable with this luck element that no matter how good the decision you make is, you aren't certain about how the future will turn out. And likewise, if you make a bad decision, it's not guaranteed that the future will turn out poorly. It might turn out well.
The two things that determine how our lives turn out are the quality of our decisions and just plain luck. But Annie, we're not very good at disentangling those two, are we?
No. And there's really two main ways which we're very poor at disentangling them. And it depends on whether you're trying to figure out why something happened for yourself versus whether you're trying to figure out why something happened for someone from afar who's, say, not your peer. So when you're trying to determine why something happened the way it did, what the quality of the decision was that led to an outcome, we fall into this trap called resulting. Mm. And what resulting is when we derive the quality of the decision solely from the quality of its outcome. There was a very famous case of this in the 2015 Super Bowl when the Seattle Seahawks were playing the New England Patriots. And Pete Carroll, who was the coach, right at the end of the game, called a pass play. And that pass play was actually intercepted. And people screamed that it was a horrible decision. Yes, he was on the 1 yard line with 26 seconds left. This was the game ender. It was a very unusual call. People expected him to run a run play. The pass got intercepted, and the argument among the pundits didn't seem to be about whether it was the worst play in Super Bowl history, but was it the worst play in Super Bowl history or the worst play in football history? There was no argument that it was a terrible play call. Now, there's been lots and lots of analysis, actually, mathematical analysis, that shows that that play call was pretty good. The main thing that you need to know is that the chance of an interception there is only about 1 or 2%. So he got an incredibly unlucky result. By the way, even Bill Belichick, the coach of the New England Patriots, agrees that it was a good play call, just so that we're clear. But the consensus was that it was a bad play call, really based solely on the fact that it was a bad result. And this is a really big mistake. If we think about this from our own lives, I mean, imagine if you really use this as the way to decide the quality of a decision. Every time you ran a red light and you got through safely, you would think it was a great decision. And every time you went through a green light and you happened to get in an accident, you would think it was a terrible decision and you would stop following the rules of the road.
You also write about something called self-serving bias. How does that work?
What happens is that when you have a good result, you say, yay me, like I won the hand because I'm so great.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have a bad result, you say, well, that wasn't my fault at all. And likewise, when you have somebody who's a peer who you consider yourself sort of in your reference group, you'll now flip the script. And you can see why, say, in poker, you would flip the script for somebody else. Because if I win a hand against you, then if I say that it's because of my good skill, then by definition, it has to be because you did something poorly in order to have your bad outcome. It can't just be luck for you and skill for me if we're competing against each other.
Right.
And likewise, if I lose a hand because of dumb luck, then you therefore must have won the hand because of dumb luck. And that's where you can see that pattern happening. But we tend to do it for anybody that we consider in our reference group. And it's probably the single thing that I would identify as the biggest problem, the biggest roadblock, the biggest obstacle to actually learning. Because in order to become an expert, you obviously have to have experience. It's necessary. But experience is not sufficient to becoming an expert. You have to actually learn well from that experience. And so how are you going to learn from your experience? Well, all you have is the outcomes of your decisions. You have some good stuff happen. You have some bad stuff happen. And you have to figure out, which things am I supposed to learn from? And notice what happens with self-serving bias. If all of the good stuff is due to luck, you're just going to reinforce all of those decisions, regardless of whether they actually led to the outcome that occurred. On the flip side, if all of the bad stuff that happens to me has nothing to do with me, that it's not my fault, where's the learning opportunity in my bad outcomes? I'm just going to shunt them off to, I can't believe the world did that to me. And now I've lost all of those learning opportunities. And you only have so many learning opportunities that come away in your life. So if you're fielding these outcomes in this very biased way, you're just going to have a really difficult time learning from the experiences that you have in any kind of efficient way.
Right. So let's go to the next question here. I think it should be pretty self-evident to listeners. But, you know, at some level, this conversation sounds a little bit like a graduate seminar in game theory or in the heuristics of decision making. So if I am a sales manager or I am a teacher or I am a physician, why should I care about this?
Well, if you're a sales manager, you should really, really care about this because you want your sales team to be making really good decisions in their strategies for selling. And you can hear this really in any industry. So in sales, why didn't you close the sale? Well, it was the end of the quarter. They had already closed it out, or somebody else had a cheaper product, and so I couldn't do anything about it. Or the guy who was the lead guy on my account just left. So notice all of these things have nothing to do with the person who's selling.
Right.
These are all things that are not their fault, right? And then what happens when they close the sale? It's because they're so great and the pitch was so wonderful and they developed a really good relationship with the person and they closed it for the highest amount that they possibly could, obviously. And all of these things that have to do with onboarding to them. Now, notice that if you start to pick that apart, I mean, here's a really good example. If you offload to something like, what could I do? The company fired the guy that was my guy, right? That was my relationship there. And so obviously I just couldn't close the sale because that happened. If you allow that just to sort of go, there's really nothing to be learned from it. But if instead you actually bring it back to, well, what were the skill elements that maybe you didn't execute on well? You can ask a question like, well, people get fired from companies all the time, or they get moved to different accounts, or they get promoted. Did you work hard to make sure that you had a backup relationship at that company?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, if you allow self-serving bias just to ride, you never get to, for example, that question of, well, okay, what can we do about it?
So self-serving bias can distort our explanations for our own failures, even our own successes, and that can prevent us from learning. I actually think there's a meta answer to this question, why should I care, that I took away from your book, and is this. When we think about what it means to be smart, and when we analogize to that, we think about chess. And we think, oh, chess players are really smart. Chess players are really good decision making. If I want my kid to be an academic superstar, I'm going to get her playing chess early on. And what you're saying, I think, is that poker is a better model for life than chess. That poker is a more accurate analog for what it means to be smart. Does that make sense to you?
So I don't want to downgrade chess players. They're really, really smart. I mean, I just want to say that. So, you know, Garry Kasparov is a really smart guy.
Sure.
He's got a lot of really interesting things to say. It's just a different kind of game.
And it's more tightly connected to game theory.
Game theory was actually modeled on a simplified version of poker by a guy named John von Neumann, who was John Nash's mentor. And he was asked, actually, by a colleague, why didn't you base it on chess? You know, chess players, exactly all the things you said. They're so smart. Isn't that the most amazing game ever? And his answer was, no, chess is not a game. It's a calculation. Poker's a game. So what he was pointing out was that chess is a calculation in the sense that because you can see all the pieces and because you don't have this really strong luck element, that if you had enough computing power, you could just compute out all the moves until the end of the game. And so that's just a computing power problem. If you have enough mathematical power, you could get there. And we can see that computers are very good at chess, and they solve checkers, which is a simplified version of chess, many years ago, because there isn't this hidden information element and this luck element. But poker is a very different game, and that's what he was pointing out, that really to really be a good decision maker, you have to get comfortable with the fact that we can't see everything. We don't have all the information when we're making decisions, and we have no idea how the future is going to turn out. We can say with some probability, and we can think about what the set of futures that might occur given a decision might be, and we could take a stab at what the probabilities of those futures are, but we can't know.
So we know that a bet is a decision about an uncertain future. We know that when we make decisions about an uncertain future, we succumb often to self-serving bias and attribute our success to skill and our failure to luck.
Mm-hmm.
We know that we should care because we are making these decisions all the time, and the essence of higher performance, not to mention greater fulfillment, is learning, and we need to learn from our decision-making failures and successes. We also know that poker is in many ways a better analog for life than chess because it involves hidden information and an element of luck. So we've got all this swirling in our heads, Annie Duke. Let me go to the third question. What should I do about this? How can I make better decisions? How can I get better at thinking in bets?
Well, I'm going to give you the simple answer first, which is try to think about your decisions as bets. Make it
Great.
Explicit that there's risk involved. I mean, imagine this. What if every time that you were about to post some proclamation on social media about something that you know to be 100% true, you thought to yourself, would I be willing to bet on this? What would happen? You would start modulating your beliefs.
Of course you would. And this is one of the great things that comes out in the book is this question, wanna bet? That is, if I make a statement saying Donald Trump is going to be reelected president in 2020, I could say that with all the force and confidence in the world. But if you then say to me, hey, Dan, want to bet? I might say, oh, well, what I really meant was I think he has a 61% chance of being reelected.
That's exactly right. Because here's the thing. This is the beautiful thing about this construct of want to bet is that the person who wins a bet, if we bet against each other a lot in the long run, the one of us that's going to do better is the one that has the most accurate representation of the objective truth rather than the representation of the world that just serves themselves. Once you say want to bet, it causes you to pull back and think, well, hold on a second. Like, how sure am I of this? Like, what do I know about this? What information do I have? What information could I be missing? Why might I be wrong? What does this other person know that I don't know? And it immediately does a few really great things. One is it pulls you into a place where you tend to moderate your view. And views that are less extreme tend to be more true. So declaring something with 100% certainty in a world where there's all sorts of hidden information and there's all sorts of luck is probably not particularly accurate. So if we can get you between 0% and 100%, like, already you're a better decision maker. But the other thing it does is notice it makes you really information hungry. Because
right.
if you challenge me to a bet, I'm now going to pull out Google. And I'm going to start checking and I'm going to start looking for resources in order to try to figure out, you know, whether my belief is accurate or how accurate my belief might be. And here's the really great thing. If we think about confirmation bias, which is this desire to sort of swat away information that disagrees with us, which is really the most valuable information, I already know why I'm right. It's more important for me to think about why I'm wrong. Once you say "want to bet" to me, now I become information hungry and I start to look for reasons that I might be wrong, opinions that disagree with me, so I can start to understand why you want to bet with me.
What else can we do? What are some other very specific things we can do to start thinking in bets, make better decisions, and avoid the self-serving bias and avoid conflating good outcomes with good decisions?
Okay, well, I think I want to give you three quick things.
Okay.
Quick thing number one is realize that this is very hard to do on your own. So go find some other people to enter into this agreement with you. So once you decide that you want to approach the world through this idea of want to bet, through this idea of building an accurate representation of the world, find some other people who are committed to it. Because if you think about it, like, I imagine that you can think of all sorts of examples of self-serving bias in other people, but you don't necessarily spot it in yourself. And that's just true for everybody. We're better at spotting it in other people. So if we can recruit a couple other people into the process with us so that we can check each other's backs. Takeaway number two is create a decision swear jar. So we have the classic swear jar. You say bad words, you got to put a dollar in the jar. So the idea that words might trigger some particular action, think about what those phrases and words are for you that signal biased thinking. Actually make a list of them. And when you hear them, you got to put a dollar in the jar.
So words like, I know this is going to happen. I guarantee this is going to happen. Those kinds of things that show incredible, undeserved confidence.
Right. And here's another one. When somebody, say, from the other side of the political aisle states an opinion and you say, they're an idiot.
Mm.
That would be a really good one to have in there, because I think that most opinions that people have aren't 100% right or 100% wrong. And when you start dismissing people with these ad hominem attacks, it's a good example of how you might be swatting away people who don't agree with you.
Got it.
Takeaway number three is be more willing to say, I'm not sure. Why? One, it's a more accurate representation of the state of your knowledge, the state of your beliefs, and certainly about any prediction you might have. I'm not sure is going to be more accurate. But number two, and this is the really wonderful thing about it, is that it causes you to be an information collector and invite people into a collaboration with you. When I express something to you like, I think Donald Trump is going to win the presidency in 2020, but I'm 61% on it. Now, all of a sudden, that invites you to tell me all the things that you know about that prediction, all the things that you think about it, and it opens the door for you to become an information gatherer. So more accurate representation of the state of your knowledge, which will make you a better decision maker, but also it really helps you calibrate your beliefs because people will start to share information with you that they have.
Annie Duke is an accomplished poker player, an expert on the psychology of decision making. Her book, Thinking in Bets, is a gem. I don't want to say I'm not sure you'll like it. I'm pretty sure you'll like it. I put it at about a 94% chance that you'll enjoy this book. Annie, thanks for being with us on the 1-3-20 podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the 1-3-20 podcast. If you want more great education to grow in your career, check out HubSpot's free online courses at HubSpot.com/learn. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please rate it and review it on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you leave your ratings and reviews.